morning, everyone, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette for Wednesday, June 29th. It's airing here on this Wednesday, June 30th. And this is IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Andrew Haupt here filling in as we are taking a look at the headlines here on page A1 of the Mason City Globe-Gazette. Well, travel writers visit Mason City. Journey inspires visiting wordsmiths on a variety of topics. That's a story written by Abby Koch. Also, Laredo's owner hands over keys. Longtime bartender buys restaurant, plans to keep what works. And also, Reynolds seeks heartbeat abortion law. The governor also asks the state's high court to set legal standard. All right, those stories and more, but let's take a check of the weather first here on the reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette. Well, for this Thursday, you can expect continuing warm conditions, cloudy and a stray shower or thunderstorm possible. Through the day, a high of 89 degrees for your Thursday. Winds out of the southwest up to 25 miles per hour today. Expect a low of 62 degrees for your overnight. For tomorrow, Friday, expect a high of 84 degrees, low of 60, and just a 4% chance of rain. Along with Saturday, you can expect a high of 81 degrees. So right about average for this time of the year, the end of June and getting into July on Friday here. As we're reading the Mason City Globe-Gazette, hope you all are having a great day, everyone. Taking a look at our first story, travel writers visit Mason City. Journey inspires visiting wordsmiths on a variety of topics. It's written by Abby Koch of the Globe-Gazette, where it reads, there was a quality about the Blue Heron Bar and Grill's Bloody Mary that made Danielle Gay want to capture in a photograph. Part of it had to deal with the restaurant co-owner Vicky Lau's inspiration for the drink. The other part was because it was stacked high with savory food items. I love history, I love food, and I'm a professional chef. Those tend to be my hot buttons, said Gay, who writes for her travel blog, The Traveling Cheesehead. Close to 10 travel writers made their way through some of the must-stops of Mason City and Clear Lake on June 21st and 22nd. Each of the writers had their own angle with what they were writing for their audience, like focusing on food or the art. I just wrote a book, 100 Things to Do Before You Die, in Lansing. My goal was to kind of introduce my audience, and because as I go out to do book signings, they ask, where else have you been? Said Amy Piper, a freelance writer who posts on Follow the Piper. I'm a music buff. I was here in Mason City in 2018 for 3 hours, and I grabbed as many things as I could, said Roxine Yonke, whose adventures can be found on Roxy on the Road. This will be a lot more than that. Visit Mason City was host to the travel writers and showed them around both Mason City and Clear Lake. Visit Mason City brand accelerator and engagement specialist Brett Batchtel helped manage the group at each stop. It's a big opportunity for our community to show all of the incredible things that we have to offer, said Batchtel. These are the kind of people that we want here visiting, and hopefully they'll have plenty of positive experiences to write about when they go home. Batchtel said Visit Mason City hopes the writers' audiences will make the journey out to North Iowa to experience both Mason City and Clear Lake. McNider Art Museum, the Surf Ballroom, and other Mason City and Clear Lake musts were part of the travelers' writers' visit. At each stop, the writers read the descriptions, scanned the visitor QR codes, and picked up tourist materials. All of the available information fascinated the guests. I love all the sculptures that you guys have. That is another big thing that a lot of people, especially families, now really appreciate, is the murals and sculptures. That's something that they can safely do whenever, said Gay. I'm excited to pull all these things together with Meredith Wilson being a musician, the sculptures, with Frank Lloyd Wright. It's all art and bringing that together for my blog post on the artist, said Piper. Both Yonke and Piper said people want to get out more, especially with how long the pandemic affected travel. But because of recent gas prices, more people are looking for a journey closer to home, says Yonke. During the pandemic, we saw how important it was to support your local community, said Yonke. It's nice to get people to understand there are other ways to travel, and this is a place that you can go and walk around and enjoy it. You don't have to go to some big metropolitan area to enjoy culture. It was the first time that Batchtel had shown off the local attractions to special visitors, which was an exciting experience for him. I think sometimes we're stuck in our office and it makes it kind of hard. It's like, how do you promote all the fun things in your community if you're not out there doing it with everybody? Giving these tours today kind of helps refresh my knowledge so that I can tell a better story as well, said Batchtel. Piper said the learning experience about the communities is the best part about traveling. I think that's the one thing about travel is getting the education that goes with it, said Piper. I'll show a photo up here. The travel writers that explored Clear Lake and Mason City on Tuesday and Wednesday of last week, five of them sitting on a bench and then two ladies standing. And on the front page, where the story starts, it shows a group of travel writers viewing Bill Baird's puppets at the McNider Art Museum during a trip through Mason City that happened on June 22nd. All right, so travel all around. Why don't we talk about Laredo's owner hands over keys. Longtime bartender buys restaurant and plans to keep what works. This written by Ray Burnett of the Globe Gazette. After 29 years, longtime owner Julie Burgo has said goodbye to Laredo's. Laredo's Facebook post of Burgo handing off the keys to longtime bartender and new owner Matt Perez garnered the attention of thousands. Burgo and Perez have been excited about this transition for months now. Burgo noted many parallels to this from the beginning of Laredo's to its new owner. Perez is taking over Laredo's at the same time of the year it first opened. His kids are the same age Burgo's were, and they both took on Laredo's at the same age. Julie Burgo and her husband Rex opened Laredo's in 1993. The little restaurant and bar was one of the first to bring live music back to Mason City. Laredo's has changed through the years, even more so the plaza, but they've stayed through it all. We were lucky to have survived the pandemic, Burgo said of the struggles through the years. We've had good, loyal customers all the way through. When they were doing capacities in here, our people made sure to come out and show their support, Perez echoed the sentiment. Perez shared his excitement taking over the business. After 20 years of working at Laredo's, he's learned the business and plans to keep what works and expand on new ideas. When asked what made him decide to take it over, it seemed like an obvious choice. It's all I know. It's what I've been doing since I was 21, Perez said. Perez plans to tweak the menu, make some small changes, and run new specials. He's excited to extend hours in the fall during hockey season and get live music back into the building for people to enjoy next month. Burgo said their outdoor seating has been a great spot for people to enjoy music as it springs up in the pavilion with spontaneous musicians plugging into the space as well as events being held. I think the fact that when coming downtown, there's a synergy of so many restaurants down here. If they can't get a spot here, they'll go to the quarry. The synergy always helps. Burgo said of the location, with all the construction that's gone on throughout Laredo's time on the plaza, both Burgo and Perez are thankful for the beautiful space it has become. As things ramp up for Matt Perez, bringing renewed vigor to business, Burgo is excited to take a step back and watch her creation stand on its own. Burgo noted she won't be a stranger to Laredo's and hinted some new plans after some time off. I'm done with the restaurant business, but I've got something in the works here in Mason City, Burgo smiled. This is written by Ray Burnett, who is a GA and crime and courts reporter at the Globe Gazette. Can be reached at 641-421-0523. And the photo here shows Laredo's, a sign that says food, drinks, music, and fun. At the top it says 1993, and that's on the left. And the caption about that photo says Laredo's outdoor seating gives customers a chance to hear live music in the plaza. And on the right, Laredo's, looks like a menu is being displayed. Matt Perez, bartender at Laredo's for 20 years, is excited to take over the business from Julie Burgo. All right, there it is. Talking about Laredo's, it looks like quite a place. And it's going to be in business still. Good for everyone up here in the Mason City area. Well, the final front page news story, Reynolds seeks heartbeat abortion law. This is a statewide story where Governor Reynolds is also asking the state's high court to set legal standard. Dateline Des Moines, the story written by Aaron Murphy. Abortions would be illegal in Iowa once a fetal heartbeat can be detected at 6 weeks, often before a woman knows she's pregnant, Under a pair of requests, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said Tuesday she plans to submit to Iowa courts. The Republican governor announced that in the wake of last week's U.S. Supreme Court ruling that overturned Roe v. Wade and repealed a woman's right to have an abortion under the federal Constitution, she will ask the Iowa Supreme Court to rehear a recent case on abortion regulations so the state court can establish what legal standard can be applied to abortion restrictions in Iowa. And Reynolds said she will ask the state courts to lift an injunction on the so-called fetal heartbeat law that was passed in 2018 but immediately stopped by the courts. The legal landscape for abortion regulations has been rewritten over the past 2 weeks in Iowa and across the country. On June 17th, the Iowa Supreme Court overturned its own 2018 decision that had declared the right to an abortion was protected by the Iowa Constitution. Exactly 1 week later, on June 24th, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the landmark 1973 decision that had made abortion access a federal right. Those rulings cleared the way for Iowa Republicans to enact stronger abortion restrictions in the state. Now is the time for us to stand up and continue the fight to protect the unborn, Reynolds said in a statement. The U.S. Supreme Court's historic decision reaffirms that states have the right to protect the innocent and defenseless unborn, and now it's time for our state to do just that. As governor, I will do whatever it takes to defend the most important freedom there is, the right to life, Reynolds said. For now, abortion remains legal in Iowa until 20 weeks of pregnancy. Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller, a Democrat, announced he will not be involved with the state's request to the courts, citing his support for the legal rationale that the U.S. Supreme Court applied to Roe v. Wade in 1973 and Planned Parenthood v. Casey in 1972, which reaffirmed Roe. Miller also recused himself from arguing the state's defense of a 2018 fetal heartbeat law that Reynolds is now asking courts to allow to be enforced. In that case, I stated that I could not zealously assert the state's position because of my core belief that the statute, if upheld, would undermine rights and protections for women, Miller said in a statement. In my nearly 40 years in office, I've declined to represent the state in only one other similar situation. I do not take lightly my responsibility to represent the state. Reynolds said the state will instead be represented by Alan Ostergren, a conservative lawyer and president and chief counsel of the Kirkwood Institute, a think tank. Reynolds' office said Ostergren will be retained at no cost to Iowa taxpayers. The top Republican leaders in Iowa's legislature, Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer from Ankeny and House Speaker Pat Grassley from New Hartford, added statements of support for Reynolds' request to the court. In 2018, the Heartbeat Bill created significant momentum across the country for conservative states to initiate legislation to protect the unborn. One of those state laws led to the historic Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization decision by the U.S. Supreme Court last week, opening the path for the 2018 law to be implemented in Iowa. Whitfer said in a statement, "I support the decision to put these laws back in front of the court to protect life in Iowa." Zach Walls, leader of the Iowa Senate Democrats from Coralville, in a statement warned that Republicans' actions will be dangerous to the health of Iowa women. "Iowa Republicans will not stop until they have completely banned abortion without exception. This is an incredibly dangerous action that threatens the health, safety, and future of Iowa women," Walls said. Reynolds' request to rehear Planned Parenthood v. Reynolds is designed to get the Iowa Supreme Court to rule what standard, if any, should be applied to abortion regulations under the Iowa Constitution. In its monumentous June 17th ruling, the state court failed to establish such standards, citing a desire to first wait for the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling on Dobbs. The Iowa Supreme Court, in its June 17th ruling, said the undue burden standard, that the previous standard would remain in effect until the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling, which came a week later. Reynolds noted the undue burden standard was used by the Iowa Supreme Court in 2015 when it struck down a law banning telemedicine abortion services. Thus, while the Iowa Supreme Court's decision was a step in the right direction, it left more work to be done in Iowa's courts to fully protect the life of the unborn, as the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Dobbs that states have an important interest in doing, Reynolds said in a news release. Governor Reynolds fully intends to do that work. All right, and moving on now to page A2 in the Mason City Globe Gazette. Today in history, that would be for June 29th, the 180th day of 2022, There would be 185 days left in the year. As of the airing of this, though, 184 left in the year. Today's highlight on June 29th, 1613, London's original Globe Theatre, which many of Shakespeare's plays were performed, was destroyed by a fire sparked by a cannon shot during a performance of Henry VIII. On this date, in 1520, Montezuma II, the ninth and last emperor of the Aztecs, died in Tenochtitlan under unclear circumstances. Some say he was killed by his own subjects, others by the Spanish. In 1767, Britain approved the Townshend Revenue Act, which imposed import duties on glass, paint, oil, lead, paper, and tea shipped to the American colonies. Colonists bitterly protested, prompting Parliament to repeal the duties except for tea. In 1776, the Virginia State Constitution was adopted, and Patrick Henry was made governor. In 1927, the first trans-Pacific airplane flight was completed, as the U.S. Army Air Corps, Lieutenant Lester L. Maitland and Lieutenant Albert F. Hagenberger arrived at Wheeler Field in Hawaii aboard the Bird of Paradise, the Atlantic Fokker C-2. After flying 2,400 miles from Oakland, California in 25 hours, 50 minutes. In 1946, authorities in British-ruled Palestine arrested more than 2,700 Jews in an attempt to stamp out extremists. In 1967, Jerusalem was reunified as Israel removed barricades separating the old city from the Israeli sector. In 1970, the United States ended a two-month military offensive into Cambodia. And that's a check of what happened on the 29th day of June across the decades. Well, moving on to page A3 now. Iowans pay over 48 cents a gallon in taxes. This is written by Aaron Murphy of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Dateline Des Moines, where Iowa drivers would save more than 18 cents per gallon on gasoline if federal lawmakers paused the federal gas tax, and another 30 cents per gallon if the state did the same. But not all lawmakers agree a gas tax holiday is a productive way to provide relief to consumers who are being impacted by inflation. Some experts warn it could make inflation even worse. The average cost Saturday for a gallon of gas in Iowa was $4.66 per gallon, according to AAA. The national average was $4.91 a gallon. Earlier this year, the national average crept over the $5 mark for the first time ever. The federal government taxes every gallon of gas 18.4 cents, and the state of Iowa, 30 cents. If Congress or the Iowa legislature approved a temporary gas tax holiday, it would reduce the cost for a gallon of gas by that much. Joe Biden on Wednesday called for a three-month federal gas tax holiday, and he called on states to do the same with their gas taxes. Biden said the temporary pause would give consumers some relief during the summer driving season. I fully understand that a gas tax holiday alone is not going to fix the problem, but it will provide families some immediate relief, just a little bit of breathing room, as we continue working to bring down the prices for the long haul, he said, according to a White House transcription of remarks he made in Washington. Fuel taxes at both the state and federal level go into government accounts that fund infrastructure maintenance and construction. The Federal Highway Trust Fund collects roughly $38 billion in annual revenue from fuel taxes over the past 4 years, according to the federal data, and Iowa's Road Use Tax Fund has collected between $640 and $700 million in its annual revenue from fuel taxes over the past 6 years, according to state data. Any suspension of fuel taxes would reduce revenue to those infrastructure funds. Biden is proposing that Congress use other federal revenues to ensure a gas tax holiday has no negative effect on the Federal Highway Trust Fund. But experts warn that pausing gas taxes could encourage people to drive more, which would increase demand for fuel and thus contribute even further to inflation. I'm not a fan. You want people to drive less and use less gas? This works against that objective, Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, said on CNN. That's why Iowa U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley said he opposes a gas tax holiday. These issues are only going to worsen the problem by stimulating consumer demand, the Republican told Iowa reporters earlier this month. Or it's not going to reduce consumer demand, and in the process, it's going to reduce productivity. Pat Grassley, the senator's grandson and the Iowa House Speaker, said late in the recently concluded session of the Iowa legislature that he did not believe a gas tax holiday was a good idea because of the potential impact on state infrastructure revenue. I don't necessarily think that that's going to be on the table because, at the same time, we have roads and bridges that all Iowans want us to continue to invest in. And to pause the state gas tax could potentially jeopardize those continued projects, the GOP speaker said. Well, Iowa increased its state gas tax by 10 cents per gallon in 2015. The state transportation department had requested the increase, citing a $215 million annual shortfall in the infrastructure revenue. Both state and federal governments are grappling with how to address long-term infrastructure funding as cars become more fuel efficient or, in the case of electric vehicles, use no fuel at all. Total fuel consumption has been declining, leading to a gradual decline in fuel tax revenue, the state's nonpartisan fiscal services agency has reported. In Iowa, road use tax fund revenues have decreased annually from the state's 2017 budget year, $699 million, to the 2021 budget year, $643 million, even though vehicle registration fees have increased over the same time, according to state data. Moving on now to national news, takeaways from the January 6th hearing, Capitol riot investigation. Former aide describes an angry and vulgar Trump. That would be Cassidy Hutchinson, a former aide to Trump White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, testifying at the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack, as depicted here on page A3. The U.S. Capitol held the hearing Tuesday in Washington. Picture here, her showing a white coat. She's wearing a black shirt or whatever you'd call underneath of it. She's got, past shoulder length brown hair. Maybe a woman probably in her early 40s. Anyway, her name is Cassidy Hutchinson. This story written by Lisa Mascaro of the Associated Press. The House January 6th committee held a surprise hearing Tuesday, delivering alarming new testimony about Donald Trump's angry, defiant, and vulgar actions as he ignored repeated warnings against summoning the mob to the Capitol and then refused to intervene to stop the deadly violence as rioters laid siege. Witness Cassidy Hutchinson, a lesser-known White House aide, rebuffed Trump's team's warnings against testifying and provided firsthand knowledge of what she saw and heard in the run-up to the January 6th 2021 insurrection, a proximity to power that gives stunning new details in the panel's year-long investigation. With calm, detailed recollections, Hutchinson testified about a defiant Trump who knew there were guns and other weapons in the rally crowd at the White House, sent his supporters to the Capitol anyway, and tried unsuccessfully to physically pry the steering wheel from his presidential limousine driver so he could join them. Before joining the White House, Hutchinson had worked in some of the most conservative Republican offices on Capitol Hill. She was hired as special assistant to the president and promoted up to Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows. Here are the highlights from the 6th hearing. Well, Trump was angry and defiant on the morning of January 6th, as so claimed. He assessed the size of the crowd for his rally in front of the White House, upset that not everyone who had answered his summons to come to Washington to get in to see him because of the security lines, told that guns, knives, and other weapons were being confiscated from the security screenings. Trump didn't care. They're not here to hurt me, the president said. He wanted to take away the magnetometer stations to allow more people inside the grounds regardless of their weaponry. Take the effing mags away, he agitated. Trump barked at the security moments before the taking the stage, Hutchinson recalled. Trump's lawyers at the White House were trying to tamp down the president's speech to the crowd he had summoned for his Stop the Steal rally on January 6th, and they were trying to stop his plans to go to the Capitol that day when Congress would be certifying the election results for Joe Biden's victory. Hutchinson testified that lawyer Eric Hirschman said it would be foolish to include some of the language the defeated president wanted to add to his speech. Comments like fighting for Trump or telling the crowd, I'll be there with you, Hirschman warned such language shouldn't be included for legal concerns and because of the optics it would portray. That language ultimately stayed in the script as Trump rallied the crowd to fight like hell and promised he would join them at the Capitol. Days before the January 6th White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, suggested that there were serious legal concerns as Trump went to the Capitol with the crowd, Hutchinson recalled. "We need to make sure this doesn't happen," she recalled Cipollone saying in the run-up to the rally. The morning of January 6th, Cipollone restated his concerns that if Trump did go to the Capitol to intervene in the certification of the election, we're going to get charged with every crime imaginable. Hutchinson then described what happened after the rally as Trump climbed into the presidential limousine, the Beast as it's called, as relayed to her later by Trump's deputy chief of staff for operations. Trump inside the vehicle tried to pry the steering wheel away from the driver, demanding to be taken to the Capitol. Proximity to power and ketchup. The hearing opened with a calm, even-spoken Hutchinson explaining her job responsibilities, advising Meadows, often handling his cell phones, as the committee showed an architectural rendering of the layout of the West Wing. Hutchinson's office was situated between the Oval Office on one side and Meadows' office on the other. Hers was also next to that of the Vice President's staff. She had an upfront view of the conversations across the offices and beyond. Hutchinson described fielding a desperate phone call as she stood backstage at Trump's rally that day from White House GOP leader Kevin McCarthy, who was upset that Trump had sent the crowd to the Capitol when she had promised they would not go. She also told of helping the White House staff mop up ketchup off the walls of the Oval Office dining room after Trump, learning that his Attorney General William Barr told the Associated Press there was no fraud on a scale to tip the presidential election, apparently hurled a plate of food at the wall. In one gripping scene, Hutchinson recalled walking Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani out of the White House when asked if she was excited about the 6th. "We're going to the Capitol. It's going to be great. The president's going to be there. He's going to look powerful," she recalled Giuliani saying. When she returned inside and told Meadows of that conversation, he told her a lot was going on. "Things might get real, real bad," Meadows told her, she recalled. Well, moving on to page A4. Here in the digest section, dozens of migrants discovered dead. Dateline San Antonio, Texas. Desperate families of migrants from Mexico and Central America frantically sought word of their loved ones as authorities began the task Tuesday of identifying 51 people who died after being abandoned in a semi-trailer without air conditioning in the Texas heat. It was the worst tragedy to claim the lives of migrants smuggled from Mexico. The driver of the truck and two other people were arrested, said U.S. Representative Henry Seller of Texas. He said the truck passed through a Border Patrol checkpoint northeast of Laredo on Interstate 35. The bodies were found Monday afternoon on the outskirts of San Antonio when a city worker heard a cry for help from the truck parked on a lonely road, Police Chief William McManus said. Joe Biden called the deaths horrifying and heartbreaking. In other news, official says no magic bullet on abortion. Dateline Washington, where Joe Biden's top health official said Tuesday that every option is on the table when it comes to helping women access abortion in the wake of the Supreme Court decision overturning Roe v. Wade. But the gap between outrage over the ruling and the administration's response appeared as wide as ever. Despite Democrats and activists pushing for swift and sweeping policies, Health and Human Services Secretary Xavier Becerra conceded that there is no magic bullet to ensure abortion access. For now, he's pledging that if there is something we can do, he will find it and we will do it at HHS. Meanwhile, a federal court Tuesday allowed Tennessee to ban abortions as early as 6 weeks into pregnancy, while in Texas, a judge temporarily blocked an even stricter decades-old law from taking effect. And in other news, brief news, Ghislaine Maxwell, the jet-setting socialite who once consorted with royals, presidents, and billionaires, was sentenced to 20 years in prison Tuesday for helping financier Jeffrey Epstein sexually abuse underage girls. Prosecutors had asked for 30 to 55 years in prison. At least some U.S. adults may get updated COVID-19 shots this fall. As government advisors voted Tuesday, it's time to tweak booster doses to better match the most recent virus strains or variants. Advisors to the Food and Drug Administration said boosters should contain some version of the Omicron variant, to be ready for an anticipated fall booster campaign. Crash. The chief elected official in the Missouri county where an Amtrak train slammed into a dump truck said Tuesday, residents and county leaders have been pushing for a safety upgrade at the railroad crossing for nearly 3 years. Meanwhile, the toll from the accident rose to 4 deaths and 150 injuries. NATO. Turkey agreed Tuesday to lift its opposition to Sweden and Finland joining NATO, a breakthrough in an impasse clouding a summit in Madrid, among Europe's worst security crisis in decades triggered by the war in Ukraine. Flint. The Michigan Supreme Court on Tuesday threw out charges against former Governor Rick Snyder and others in the Flint water scandal, saying a judge sitting as a one-person grand jury had no power to issue indictments under rarely used state laws. And finally, sentence. Former Republican U.S. Representative Jeff Fortenberry of Nebraska was sentenced Tuesday to 2 years of probation, a $25,000 fine, and community service for lying to federal authorities about an illegal campaign contribution. On the same day, the voters in his district were deciding on his replacement in a special election. Anyway, some news briefs there from the Associated Press. Moving on to obituaries, because we are at the halfway point here of the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette here on Iris. I am your reader. My name is Andrew Haupt. All material heard on Iris is solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. If you have any comments or other questions about this Iris program, please give us a call at 515-243-6833. We're taking a look now at the obituaries. And we have James Baldwin, 82, of Iowa Falls, died Monday, June 27th, at Hospice of North Iowa in Mason City. Arrangements are under the Council Woodley Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Iowa Falls. We also have Diana D. Knauf, age 67, of Boone, died Sunday, June 26th, at her home in Boone. Arrangements are under the Council Woodley Funeral Home. And Evelyn L. Pilchard, age 78, of Iowa Falls, died Monday, June 27th, at Hospice of North Iowa in Mason City. Arrangements are under the Council Woodley Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Iowa Falls. And in full obituaries, we have Sindra Stricker Lingberg, who lived May 26, 1950 to June 12, 2022. Sindra Stricker Lingberg, age 72, of McKinney, Texas, passed away peacefully on June 12, 2022, surrounded by her friends and family. Sindra was born on May 26, 1950, to Ralph and Geraldine Stricker in Mason City, Iowa, immediately brought joy and hard work into the world. Sindra fell in love with insurance, which kicked off a 46-year career in the field. In 1995, she met Michael Lingberg, and the two were inseparable from that point on. Mike and Sindra were married for over 24 years and have 3 children, Kayla, Vitko, Katrina Kerber, and Nathan Lingberg. Sindra was a fiercely dedicated mom and grandmother to all of her 8 grandchildren and wanted them to go on to accomplish great things. Family came first and was above all else to Sindra, a value she instilled in all those around her. The hole left by her absence is impossible to fill. Sindra was predeceased by Ralph, Jerry, and Carrie Stricker. She is survived by Kenny and Cindy Stricker of Champlain, Minnesota. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation in Sindra's name to the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. A celebration of life will be October 1st in White Rite, Texas. Robert Harris lived August 16, 1957 to June 22, 2022. Of Mason City, Robert Harris, age 64, died on Wednesday, June 22nd at his Mason City, Iowa home. Graveside service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on June 30th, that's today, at the Kensett Cemetery, located at 410th Street in Kensett, Iowa. All are welcome to attend. A lunch and time for sharing memories from 12 noon to 3 p.m. at Coonan's Quarry, located at 1555 450th Street, Northwood, Iowa. Family suggests that memorials may be directed to the North Iowa Community Kitchen. Bob was born August 16, 1957, the son of Vernon and Judith Colgard Harris. He was a graduate of St. Ansgar High School's class of 1977. After graduation, Bob worked for local farmers and several manufacturers. That'd be Farmstead Foods, Carroll George Inc., Triggs Trailers, Mason City Fence, as well as Suka. Eventually, he worked in carpentry until his health declined. One of Bob's favorite pastimes was fishing, often along the Shell Rock River. He also enjoyed camping, hunting, woodworking, gardening, and birdwatching. He took pride in having a well-manicured lawn for those who passed to enjoy. He spent most of his life in Iowa, but he explored living in Denver, Colorado, Florida, and South Dakota. Bob was a fan of classic cars, motorcycles, and rock and roll, listening to an extensive collection on vinyl. Although Bob didn't have any children of his own, he considered his nieces and nephews a big part of his life and loved them dearly. Those left to cherish memories of Bob are his sisters, Bonnie married to Gerald Charlson, Susan married to Dean Cowell, Catherine married to Stephen Marshall, Linda married to George Kaufman, nieces and nephews, Angela married to Brian Thompson, Brian married to Robin Charlson, Nicole married to Rob Nelson, Tammy married to Jason Dickens, Wendy married to John Trihus, Jason married to Jesse Cowell, Megan married to Rob Evans, Sarah married to Luis Garcia, Jacob married to Mariah Marshall, Tiffany Prince, and Joshua married to Heather Kaufman, Aunt Irma Harris, many great nieces, nephews, and cousins, as well as his furry companion, Gunner. Bob is preceded in death by his parents, Vernon and Judith Harris, and his brother, Steve. Bride Colonial Chapel at 110 East Spring Street in Manly. It's 641-454-2242. ColonialChapels.com is the funeral home given. Well, moving on to some additional news now before we check in with some sports news. On page A5, famine threatens part of the world. This is written by Tracy Wilkinson of the Los Angeles Times, Dateline Washington. The scenes as witnessed by journalists and humanitarian workers in recent months have been striking. In Sudan, swollen-bellied babies are looking for anything to eat. In Yemen, where warring parties have blocked humanitarian aid, hollow-eyed children and their mothers languish on the brink of death from starvation. In Ukraine, the elderly are collecting rancid rain runoff for drinking water. Malnourishment and hunger were big problems even before Russia invaded Ukraine in February and cut off Europe's breadbasket from its markets, sparking a flurry of dire warnings about the world's food supplies. Dozens of countries across the globe are already suffering from devastating food shortages, so much so that the number of people facing starvation more than doubled in just the last 2 years to 345 million, according to United Nations figures. The causes are myriad: drought and flooding, and the interruption of supply chains triggered by the COVID-19 pandemic, especially in China. An estimated 20 wars or conflicts, the latest in Ukraine, have also seriously disrupted access to food and water. The current food security challenge that we're facing is due to these three C's. That would be climate, COVID, and conflict, said Ramin Tulluhi, Assistant Secretary of State for Economic Affairs, one of several Biden administration officials tasked to food security issues. The bleak situation drew the attention of powerful diplomats last week when U.S. Secretary of State Antony J. Blinken and foreign ministers of six other of the world's largest economies met in Germany to map out plans for easing global food shortages. Few observers expect real solutions to emerge, but hope the summit will highlight the crisis and boost funding for anti-hunger efforts. The Biden administration has committed about $8.5 billion to emergency food assistance and related programs, focusing initially on the Horn of Africa, Yemen, Lebanon, and Haiti, Blinken said. We hear all these numbers. We've all cited numbers of this growing food insecurity, Blinken said in Berlin. But what we know is this. We know that those numbers are people, real lives, real livelihoods, mothers, fathers, children. As human beings, all of us have to be seized with this. The UN's World Food Program calculates that 8 of the 10 largest food crises worldwide are being primarily driven by conflict in Yemen, Ethiopia, Afghanistan, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Such wars force people from their homes into long, desperate treks for safety. They devastate farms and wreak havoc on food distribution systems. In Latin America, food scarcity is also driving tens of thousands of people to abandon parched or hurricane-leveled farms and migrate to the United States. These were the disasters already in motion when Russia invaded Ukraine. Now the UN says the Russian blockade of Ukraine's Black Sea ports could lead 40 million more people to go hungry. We have to realize that this crisis that we're experiencing now is not one that is going to go away in the next few weeks or months, said Kerry Fowler, the administration's special envoy for global food security and the founder of the famous Norway-based Seed Vault that is preserving thousands of food species. We have to begin to think about this as an acute crisis that will last for a couple of years, unfortunately. The world's confrontation with starvation intensified in February as Russia invaded its western neighbor Ukraine and blockaded the country's Black Sea ports. Ukraine exports much of its grain, wheat, and other foodstuffs from those ports, which are now menaced by Russia's fleet. The blockade is no small matter. Ukraine is the world's fifth largest exporter of wheat and corn, and a leading supplier of vegetable oil and fertilizer. By one estimate, nearly 25 million tons of grain is sitting in Ukrainian silos and warehouses, likely to rot. Attempts to reroute the supplies overland would be expensive and extremely difficult, in part because Ukrainian railway carriages would have to be refitted to work in other parts of Europe. Third-party naval escorts have also been largely ruled out because it could lead to direct conflict with Russia, which is unlikely to let up its quarantine of Ukraine's ports. Parts of the Black Sea have also been mined by Ukraine, adding another layer of danger. Some experts contend the best solution is to arm Ukraine with longer-range artillery and aircraft, such as unmanned MQ-9 Reaper vehicles equipped with precision-guided missiles, so that it can take out Russian ships. Getting the grain and wheat out of Ukraine is only part of the problem. The war is ravaging fertile fields, disrupting harvests, destroying storage silos, and killing farmers. When Russian bombs ruin a farm in eastern Ukraine, for example, there is a strong chance that family in Lebanon, which receives 80% of its grain from Ukraine, won't have bread, aid workers say. Well, John Hinckley's back on the news and apologizes for the shooting that wounded Ronald Reagan. This is an AP story from Washington. The man who wounded President Ronald Reagan in 1981 apologized for his actions Tuesday and said he doesn't remember what he was feeling when he fired the shots that also wounded three others. John Hinckley Jr. told CBS Mornings in his first televised interview since he was freed from all court oversight this month that he feels sorry for all the lives his actions affected. I feel badly for all of them. If I have true remorse for what I did, Hinckley said. I know that they probably can't forgive me now, but I just want them to know that I am sorry for what I did. Going back to that day, Hinckley recalled Reagan walking out of the Washington Hilton after giving a speech. And I was right there. I fired the shots at him, which so unfortunately hit other people too. Asked what feelings led him to shoot, Hinckley said he can't remember those emotions and doesn't want to. It's such another lifetime ago. I can't tell you now the emotion I had right as Reagan came walking out. I can't tell you that, he said, later adding, it's something I don't want to remember. Hinckley was 25 and suffering from acute psychosis when his gunshots wounded Reagan and three others. The assassination attempt paralyzed Reagan Press Secretary James Brady, who died in 2014. It also wounded a police officer and a Secret Service agent. Hinckley told Major Garrett, CBS News chief Washington correspondent, that he's glad he didn't succeed. He said that at the time of the shooting, he did not have a good heart and was doing things a good person doesn't do. Jurors found Hinckley not guilty by reason of insanity, and he spent decades at a mental hospital in Washington. I was not just a cold, calculating criminal in 1981, he said. I truly believe I had a serious mental illness that was preventing me from knowing right from wrong back then. Hinckley began making visits to his parents' home in Williamsburg, Virginia in the early 2000s. A 2016 court order granted him permission to live with his mother full-time, albeit under various restrictions, after experts said his mental health illness had been in remission for decades. He signed a lease on a one-bedroom apartment in the Williamsburg area last year and has been living alone there with his cat, according to court documents. His mother died in July. He's also been releasing songs online and looking for a venue willing to let him sing and play guitar before a live audience. Hinckley had previously been under restrictions that barred him from owning a gun, using drugs or alcohol, or contacting members of the victims' families. but a federal judge in Washington had said months ago that he would free Hinckley from those restrictions if he remained mentally stable. Those restrictions were lifted on June 15th. Tuesday's apology was not Hinckley's first. His attorney, Barry Levine, said during a court hearing last year that Hinckley wanted to express his heartfelt apologies and profound regret to the people he shot and their families, as well as to actress Jodie Foster, who he was obsessed with at the time of the shooting, and to the American people. As Hinckley expressed his regrets on Tuesday, he said he hopes to soften the public's perception of him. "I'm just trying to show people I'm kind of an ordinary guy who's just trying to get along like everybody else," he said. But he doesn't expect to see forgiveness from his victims, saying, "I really don't think that the Brady family or the Reagan family or Jodie Foster, I don't think they want to hear from me. I feel terrible for what I did," he said. "If I could take it all back, I would. I swear I would take it all back." And now with one last story before we send it over to the sports section. Senate Sergeant-at-Arms during riot dies at age 71. Washington, D.C. is where this is from. It's an Associated Press story. Michael Balsamo and Sophia Tulp. Michael Stanger, who served as the U.S. Senate Sergeant-at-Arms and resigned after the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol, has died. He was age 71. Stanger died Monday of natural causes, according to two people familiar with the matter. One of the people said he had been diagnosed with cancer and had been ill. The people would not discuss details of his condition publicly and spoke to the Associated Press on condition of anonymity. Stanger had served in the role as a sergeant-at-arms of the Senate since 2018 and had previously worked for the U.S. Secret Service for more than three decades. Senator Mitch McConnell, who was majority leader at the time, requested Stanger's resignation the day after the pro-Trump mob stormed the Capitol. The Senate's top Democrat, Senator Chuck Schumer, had vowed that he would fire Stanger when he became Senate Majority Leader later in the month. The House Sergeant-at-Arms Paul Irving and Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sund also resigned after the event. Stanger and Irving testified to the Senate Rules Committee in February of 2021 about security at the Capitol. The response to the event and the decision in the days leading up to it, as members of the Capitol Police Board, which oversees the force, to not have the National Guard at the Capitol in order to quell any violence. Stanger was also mentioned extensively in the committee's report examining the attack. News of Stanger's passing on Tuesday fueled conspiracy theories online, with some social media users calling his death suspicious and attempting to link it to the surprise January 6th hearing announced just 24 hours earlier by the House Committee investigating the Capitol event on January 6th. Stanger died of natural causes, and there is no evidence he was set to testify at that hearing. Cassidy Hutchinson, a White House aide, testified before the committee. Other posts identified Stanger's cause of death, claiming he was shot and killed in the street in a targeted attack. Those claims appeared to conflate details from a 2013 report about the unrelated death of a 20-year-old in California with the same name. And checking in with our sports section, Collins ready to prove himself again. The Charles City Star commits to Iowa as preferred walk-on. This written by Zach Martin of the Globe Gazette. At this point in the recruiting process, Ian Collins knew that getting a scholarship wasn't in the realm of possibility. If he wanted to continue his track and field career at the highest level, he'd have to walk on. Fine by him. "I love being in this position," Collins said. "I'll pop out one time and show everybody else who I am, prove myself again." It took one weekend visit to the University of Iowa campus to solidify Collins' decision as he accepted a preferred walk-on spot with its men's track and field program late last week. He posted a picture of himself in a Hawkeye jersey on Instagram with the caption reading, #committed. "It was where I liked it in the best and where I saw myself growing as a person, as an athlete," Collins said. The decision ends a journey for Collins that wasn't all that smooth sailing during his final year at Charles City High School. An ankle injury suffered over spring break hindered the progress he made during the offseason. Prior to the setback, he stated he was clearing 7 feet even on the high jump and leaping well over 24 feet in the long jump. "It is so hard to take that in," Collins said after the Comets home meet in April. "It is like starting over for me completely." He continued to jump through it and earned a top five finish in the high jump at the Drake Relays and won Northeast Iowa Conference Plus Class 3A district titles in both jumping events. At the state meet in May, he won a head-to-head battle with North Polk's Jack Noble for the second straight year in the high jump when Collins cleared 6-9. He had three chances at 6-10 and all just barely missed. "It is just excitement right now," Collins said after the victory at Drake Stadium. "I had confidence that I could do it, but I hadn't done it yet this year. Happy with how today went, even though I got sunburnt." In the long jump, Collins finished second with a best jump of 23 feet, 1/4 inch. He came desperately close to another state title, but it wasn't meant to be. Still in his eyes, he proved people wrong all week with what he was able to accomplish, and he made sure to give his full gratitude to the people who never doubted him. "I still got people in my corner supporting me," Collins said after munching on Subway. "It is pride for the Charles City Comets and saying for my city for the 641, or 641. "We have heart and we're different from everybody else." Collins' prep career concluded with three state championships, one Drake Relays title, and several NEIC victories. Now he gets to embark on the collegiate journey. There were two options, Collins considered, Iowa and Arkansas. The Razorbacks bestow one of the premier Division I programs in the country. The Hawkeyes have grown into a routine contender for Big Ten championships. Staying in-state and being closer to home were two big selling points. "I also just saw the culture at Iowa," Collins said. "It was the type of place you want to be as an athlete. They're in the perfect position as a team." Under Joey Woody, the Hawkeyes have established themselves as a program on the rise. Collins wanted to be a part of that, and he'll have plenty of opportunities to do so. He'll do both jumping events plus some short sprinting events. He didn't rule out of the line doing the triple jump. "Hopefully I come in, jump well right away, and earn myself a scholarship," Collins said. As for the ankle, Collins said it is getting better. At the Nike Outdoor Nationals held at Hayward Field in Oregon, he said he felt great in the long jump despite scratching all three jumps. The ankle didn't hinder him a little bit in the high jump, and he was only able to clear the opening height of 6 to 3.25. He said he believes he'll be fully healthy come next spring with continued strength. "I've been working really hard on it," Collins said. "It is good to have that feeling, getting everything back to how it was." All right, and one final sports story, chance galore for HD Cal, infusing energy the upside during Bulldogs' seven-game skid. That's written by Aaron Hickman of the Globe Gazette. That'd be Hampton, Dumont, Cal. That were their softball game, the cheers from the dugout are just as much a part of the action as what's going on the field. With a special chant for every single player in the lineup, the Bulldogs help pump up the batters at the plate and the pitchers in the circle. There's a chant, "Niner, Niner, hit a line driver," for Emma Ott, who sports the number 9. When Aubrey Showalter is at the plate, the dugout verbally spams 1 as she wears the number 11 on her back. Those are just a few of the cheers that are tailor-made for the players. The team can also make anything fit into the famous Olé chant that is often heard at soccer games. All the players seem to enjoy their own individual chants, whether it gets them locked in at the plate or helps them to break character with a laugh during an intense moment. The value of the dugout atmosphere is easy to understand. There can be some exceptions, though. Sometimes the coaches don't like it because there's a bunch of screaming, Tegan Bird said with a chuckle. Even if the coaches don't always enjoy the screaming from the dugout, they know just how important it is. Head coach Kelsey Enslin has emphasized positive cheering in ways to promote the team. She believes the dugout has been a huge part of keeping the girls up during a season that hasn't always been easy. She also wants everyone to know that even if you're not out in the field making plays, what happens in the dugout is just as important. "We talk a lot about how everyone has a role on the team and them understanding that even if your role is your cheering, that's a big part of what's happening," Enslin said. "You're not just in this dugout, you're knowing what's going on. You're cheering for things. You're excited. It keeps our energy up as a team. There's a notebook where the team writes down different chants. Sometimes they are inspired by cheers from other programs that they find online or in social media. A lot of that time, they use their own creativity to conjure up the latest bit of encouragement. The activity from the dugout helps players like pitcher Avery Hansen, who always has eyes on her when she's in the circle. Having that support system to back her up means a lot, and it helps to have a group of girls who are always ready to lift up the players out on the field. We've played with each other for so long, Hansen said. As a team, we're really experienced with one another, so just to have that bonding and those relationships, it's really awesome to have those memories and just to know those girls. With 3 games left in the regular season before a meeting with Clarion Goldfield Dows in a Class 3A Region 3 quarterfinal, being stuck in a 7-game losing streak isn't an ideal spot to be in. But with the dugout there to light the torch and keep the flame energy burning, the team will have a shot to create some surprises. Everyone is back to 0-0 in the postseason, and that makes this time of year so special. The only thing that matters is your district and who you play in the first round, Hansen said. I don't care if we're on a seven-game losing streak. It doesn't matter to me as long as we beat Clarion in the first round. Well, and that's a check of the Mason City Globe Gazette for June the 29th, airing here on Thursday, June 30th. And that is all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. This has been Andrew Haupt filling in. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day, everyone, and straight ahead.